Welcome to Bina, KAALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. In the first part of the hour, we feature a special program on the 2020 elections and the Jewish vote, featuring political scientist and author Dr. Stephen Windmiller. And in the last part of the hour, our guest is poet Juan Felipe Herrera, who was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017, and the first Hispanic poet to serve in the position. His new collection of poetry, Every Day We Get More Illegal, was released in September. And now join Alice Star Sachs, Program Manager of Young Professionals and Civic Engagement at the Jewish Community Center of the East Bay, as she introduces Dr. Stephen Windmiller.
Power Through Voting is a nonpartisan series of programs relating to the 2020 election brought to you by all seven Bay Area JCCs, JCC East Bay, the Peninsula JCC, the Oshman Family JCC, JCCSF, the Marin JCC, the Los Gatos JCC, and the Sonoma JCC. Creating events and resources around the election is important to us as Jewish community centers because taking part in voting, as well as thinking critically about the issues, strongly ties into the Jewish value of tikkun olam, meaning repairing the world. In that light, we are glad to have Dr. Stephen Windmiller with us tonight sharing his 2020 election analysis. Dr. Windmiller's work in Jewish political behavior has been central to his research and writings, and he is considered a great political mind in the field. His nonpartisan analysis is designed to educate about the diverse and significant roles Jews have played and continue to play in American politics. Dr. Windmiller, we are grateful that you have chosen to spend this time with us. With that, I turn it over to you for your presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Alice Star, and to all of you from the various JCC family of community in the Bay Area, I'm really pleased to be with you. We are certainly all familiar with the reality that American Jews have had a long history associated with political engagement, and that since the inception of the American Republic, Jews have been connected deeply with this nation, its evolution, and its development. I have written extensively about what I define as the Jewish contract with America, where American Jews have fully understood that this was a unique experiment in democracy. And from the outset, whether with regard to the First Amendment to the Constitution, with its call for the rights of religious liberty, public speech practice, what has been very clear is that along with Article 6 of the Constitution, with its declaration that there is no religious test for public office, the reality is that America was a hospitable and welcoming place for our community. I'm reminded of the fact, however, that in the early history of this nation, states such as Maryland, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania were slow in developing full and equal opportunity for Jewish political participation. But ultimately, by the period of 1840s, American Jews were not only politically involved, but they were running for public office. In fact, the first senator, who was from Florida, David Yulee, would win election to the United States Senate the same year that a first member of the Pennsylvania delegation to the Congress would arrive at the House of Representatives. And over the course of American history, we have seen a significant number of individual Jews play critical roles in both Washington, their state capitals, and also within city and local administrations. For example, the 116th Congress, the current Congress, has 28 Jewish members. And as we recall, there are 9 U.S. senators who are also Jewish. 1993 would mark the highlight where the 103rd Congress had 51 Jews who were part of that particular congressional delegation. But Jews play a much wider role in American politics than simply running for public office and serving in those offices. They are funders, they are activists, they are commentators on the American political scene, and they vote in extraordinarily high numbers. In many ways, the election that we are about to undertake is tied, interestingly enough, to the question of who votes. And Americans in general are not high-level voters. In fact, on average, less than 60% of eligible American voters turn out at the polls. We have seen a high in 1908 when the United States saw 65.7% of its voters participate. In 1960, for example, in the Kennedy-Nixon campaign, 63.8%. But since 1960, that number has never really gone well over 60%. And what we are anticipating in the 2020 election is that we will have a significantly higher turnout. If there were 139 million Americans voting in 2016, we expect that number to be well over 150 million voting this year. In particular, the Jewish community votes are much higher. On average, 85% of eligible Jewish voters participate. And those numbers have ranged from 72 to 85% over the last 20 years. So that has been an important storyline because of the high viability and engagement of Jews as voters in the American electorate. But the new story is the role of Jews as part of the financial support for candidates, campaigns, and causes. Jewish giving is significant. And some who write about the levels of Jewish financial support suggest that one out of every $2 raised by the Democratic Party is generated from Jewish sources. One in every four commitments to the Republican Party are from Jewish donors. This is an extraordinary number. We believe that Hillary Clinton's top five donors in 2016 were Jewish, and seven of Donald Trump's top 17 donors happened to be Jewish. So what will we expect this year in this election? This election is now well underway. 28 states are already voting. And what we need to understand is that we will see a huge number of new voters turning out in 2020. We believe that as many as 20 million new Americans are now eligible, whether by age or by citizenship, to be able to vote in this election. Many of these voters are also people of color, new Americans, and will add a different dimension to the voting characteristics ahead. We believe that as we go forward from 2020, well into the mid part of this century, we will see a fundamental shift in voting in terms of the demographics of this country. By the mid-year 2050, America will cease to be a white majority society, and as a result, its voting base will likewise change. One of the concerns often raised in voting has to do with the protection of the ballot. And no doubt, as you are following, there are numerous court actions, and there will be additional court hearings in connection with voting practices, whether that has to do with mail-in ballots or the counting of votes or who is eligible to vote. But we will be watching those in particular as we move forward, just as we have seen in the past several days, actions taken in various states to clarify voting rights and opportunities. As recently as today, a decision from one member of the Supreme Court with regard to Montana in terms of absentee and mail-in balloting. In looking at Jewish voters, what some have recently begun to identify is that while Jews are very pro-Israel, Israel is not a high-profile item in terms of American Jewish voting patterns, and that the liberal character of much of the Jewish vote is reflected in this statement, more pro-choice than pro-Israel. But the Jewish community's voting behavior, as we will look at in a few moments, is much more complex than that statement. We believe that reasons for American Jewish activism and voting are tied to this notion of exceptionalism. The Jews really believe that this system is comfortable for them, they are historically tied to it, and they have a responsibility, they believe, for fully participating, which is why there is such a high voter turnout and a reflection of deep commitment to American values. Milton Himmelfarb in 1973 suggested that Jews live like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. In many ways, that is a slice on this larger question about the behavior of Jewish voting. From the New York Times exit poll of 2016, following the November elections in that year, we accounted for Hillary Clinton receiving about 71% of Jewish votes and Donald Trump 24%. In reality, American Jews live in a very concentrated set of states, as seen in this statement that 75% of America's Jews live basically in eight states and account for 188 electoral votes in those states. And if we were to add the next eight states where there are significant Jewish populations, it would bring the total to 300 electoral votes and account for more than 80% of America's Jewish community. This year, the election will be about a series of states, including Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, Ohio, and Florida. Some have called this the Bagel Belt. Well, there are significant Jewish populations in these states. The reality is that in a very close election, 1 or 2 percentage points can determine an outcome. And with Jewish populations of some significance in these states, these voters are getting a great deal of attention on the part of both Jewish Republican and Jewish Democratic workers in promoting their candidates. Jewish voting patterns over time have been interesting to follow. What we see here are that numbers of Jewish candidates running for office since 1948, we can follow the patterns of Jewish voting. From roughly 1912, moving forward, we have begun to see an emergence of a Democratic shift as Jewish voters in the 19th century from 1864 until 1912, roughly, voted overwhelmingly Republican. And what we are seeing in certainly the 20th century is this particular pattern of shifting in voting. I want you to take a look at the 1980 election, which involved Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. You will note in that particular election, there was a third party candidate who did particularly well with Jewish voters, Congressman John Anderson. The important thing here is that Ronald Reagan's 39% is a clear shift in Jewish voting that had occurred prior to that point. What political scientists could not quite figure out was why the shift did not hold in 1984 when Reagan ran for his second term. The loss of 8 points. And what we uncovered was an interesting story about 1983, the rise of the moral majority, and a clear concern on the part of many American Jewish voters that American politics would become highly religiously based, and that would distort and undermine their concerns about separation of church and state. So that a significant portion of the Reagan vote dissipated in 1984. But as you will see, the patterns here are reasonably significant and take us through the period of President Obama's campaign. And here again, if you look at 2008 and 2012, you will see again a decline in support for the Democratic candidate, Barack Obama. Part of the loss there was that the president suffered losses from every one of his major constituencies. Women, minorities, and Jewish voters were amongst those who in 2012 shifted parts of their vote away from the president. I think we want to take a few moments and look at both political traditions, conservative Jewish thought, and later we will take a look at liberal political thought as well. In many ways, American Jews are an anomaly in terms of their voting and political behavior. That is, throughout the rest of the diaspora, and even in the state of Israel, we find that Jewish voters tend to be far more conservative than they are in the United States. And the pattern of conservative political thought is deeply embedded in much of the 19th century history of both a Jewish practice in this country, but also throughout Western Europe. As we have moved into the 21st century, we've identified sort of five core ideas that define different aspects or segments of Republican Jewish voters. Identity voters vote, in a sense, around the question, is it good for the Jews? They begin with their own sense of concern for community, security, and Israel. Identity voters can be a cross-section of new American Jews, of entrepreneurs, and of others who have a profound and deep interest in protecting a set of core interests that they perceive as central to their political ideology. Neoconservatives, the neocons, were really part of the Reagan revolution. They became an important piece to the foreign policy establishment in this country, and their ideas about democracy being, in a sense, marketed in the world and protecting America's allies in the world was a central sort of core theme for both their thinking as it influenced the ideas of the Republican national base. Ideological conservatives are deeply rooted in American history. They are more frequently found in the Midwest and South. They have long-term historic ties to the grand old party, the GOP, the Republican Party. And their views and ideas are tied basically to their neighbors' perspectives about republicanism. Religious value conservatives are those often found in the Orthodox community. And we believe that something on the order of 68% of Haredi Jews, that is ultra-Orthodox Jews, will tend to support President Trump and continue to be particularly vocal in terms of religious values as a core theme that joins them with evangelicals. Modern Orthodox Jews, probably around 36%, are aligned with the Trump candidacy and reflect similar political views that align them with the religious values community. What we saw emerging in 2016 were never Trump Republicans, and they remain active here in 2020. These are very prominent Republicans active today in the Lincoln Project and other avenues of the Republican Party, designed in a sense to challenge the president as not being an authentic Republican or a Republican with whom they are comfortable. So we have these five ideological camps inside the Republican Jewish establishment that give us a clue to thinking about the general behavior of Republicans in Jewish community. Jewish liberalism is really a late 19th century and early 20th century phenomenon. It emerges from a variety of sources, the emancipation as expressed in Europe, as developed by religious progressive ideas taken from the prophetic tradition. It is drawn from a whole host of liberal agendas that were part of the 20th century's development. And it has been framed around a variety of different causes and issues. Not all American Jewish liberals are alike. And here again, we take a look at the divisions amongst and within the democratic circles of Jewish liberalism. Universal progressives represent the first group and are often folks who deal with and are very active in parts of the progressive movement Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren represented in the primaries and that have been part of the political conversation over the past number of years.
You're listening to a special program on the 2020 elections and the Jewish vote, featuring political scientist and author Dr. Stephen Windmiller on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Universal progressives, however, did not show up in 2016 to support Hillary Clinton. The Brandeis University study on millennial Jews who were Bernie supporters indicates an interesting correlation that between 8 and 10% of this circle of progressives simply sat out the 2016 election. Liberal suburban Democrats are a combination of folks who reflect a variety of different interests. They come to this, whether it's about climate change, healthcare, or a host of other, both single issue or collective issues that define their liberalism as Democrats. Urban activists are an emerging group. These are younger voters who are increasingly moving out of the Democratic Party to become independent voters. And that is a pattern we are seeing not just in the Jewish community, but we see this with white young voters in urban centers across the country, where many of them would prefer to be identified as independents rather than be politically aligned with either of the two major parties. This fourth group, the red diaper babies, is actually a very old phenomenon, because the oldest piece to the liberal movement in America really is the socialist camp. And these are the great-great-grandchildren of these early socialists. Their parents may have been active, or grandparents, in anti-war activities against Vietnam, for example. But these younger folks have clearly adopted a much more radicalized version of politics and are seen as part of this socialist tradition that was deeply embedded in Jewish thought in the 19th century, carried over into the 20th century, tied in part to the Democratic Party and to other progressive causes. You would see the last of these, the libertarians, and say, Dr. Windmiller, this doesn't belong here. Libertarians are part of a Republican base. Jewish political science suggests that these folks, in the case of being Jewish libertarians, are much more democratic in their outlook in terms of their values and ideas than they are Republican. And while they may not necessarily always vote Democratic, and nor do they believe in some of the values and propositions of the Democratic Party, they fit more neatly into the Democratic camp as American Jewish libertarians than as Republicans. In many ways, the 2020 election is very much focused, as we all know, about this current president, often to be understood in terms of a referendum on the presidency of Donald Trump. This is an election also that has raised and continues to raise a lot of conversation about voter suppression and issues of disinformation, more specifically about foreign influence. And indeed, before the House Intelligence Committee just last week, we saw a whole litany of reports about Iran, China, Venezuela, and Russia, all participating in ways to influence social media campaigns affecting the 2020 election. This is an election also very much about ballot counting and the role that the post office will be playing. So it has raised numerous questions about authenticity, accuracy of the vote, and the efficiency of being able to deliver those ballots in a timely and appropriate manner. And we would remind ourselves that each state establishes for itself their own guidelines, rules, and regulations associated with voting. So this is not about a United States platform of rules of voting. This is 50 individualized states, their historic record on voting, their policies with regard to voting, and their ways by which they account and manage ballots. One of the things that is of particular concern to Jewish audiences are conspiracy theories and the effect of many of these theories and actions directed against the Jewish community and other minority groups. The Anti-Defamation League announced that Jewish candidates, as well as Jewish elected officials in the Congress in particular, were being identified, targeted, and faced a huge amount of anti-Semitic harassment from a variety of extremist groups and conspiratorial theorists who were introduced onto their web pages and onto their websites materials of a conspiratorial nature. The trust factor is a key issue in American politics. And if people do not believe that the election is appropriately being managed, controlled, they will become, as they have become, deeply concerned about the authenticity of the vote and its outcome. Trust is an important additional factor for American Jews because we have always believed that this system worked to the advantage of making these elections safe, secure, reliable outcomes. So I am particularly interested to watch how American Jewish voters will answer questions on the exit polling, dealing with their levels of trust and confidence in the outcome. This is an election, as have been at least the last four presidential campaigns, where we have seen and are seeing a huge number of Jewish candidates, of Jewish connections to candidates. As we would note that both the president has Jewish family, Joe Biden has a series of Jewish family connections, and Kamala Harris has as well ties through her husband to the Jewish community. The reality is that we are seeing significant numbers of candidates running for office across the country who are themselves Jewish or who are living with Jewish partners. And so the election has a deep and special connection, certainly to many Jewish voters. I think the election is in many ways about the state of our democracy and our role in the world. It is a question of where we are going, and in many ways, it is a referendum on how people see the state of this union. I think that the reality of 2016 was that Jews did not vote in the same significant numbers that they had voted in previous elections. We do not expect that to be the outcome in 2020. What we do believe, we will see a number of new voters, including the growing and significant presence of Orthodox voting behavior in major metropolitan areas. What we are concerned about is that for the first time in American history, we are facing a challenge of anti-Semitism from the right and anti-Israel and anti-Semitic actions as well from the left. This places the Jewish community in a highly concerned and vulnerable position. And every study done on American Jews in the last several years has shown a significant increase in the concerns around heightened anti-Semitism from both the right and the left. What we have also seen, especially in 2018, in the mid-year elections, we are seeing in the summer of 2020 is a surge in Jewish political giving for both parties and for multiple candidates. We are also fully aware of the great Jewish divide, whether it's Israeli policy or questions related to Donald Trump and his relationships to American Jews over a variety of issues. The divide is deep and it is of grave concern. American Jews have significant political clout. That clout is clearly divided today as it is resting both in Republican circles and Democratic camps. And it is seen as important because of the role that Jews are playing economically in American politics. We have already discussed the changing American majority And that will be an important reality, something that younger voters will be certainly very much akin to. The American Jewish voter is amongst the oldest religious ethnic voter group in this nation. While we only comprise about 1.8% of the nation's population, I think we will see huge changes to American political parties that Jews will be actually a very important piece to, looking toward the future, as political parties will have to figure out how they message themselves to people who share their interests, and whether or not we are a two-party country, we need to rethink the party system, the greater diversities of political viewpoints that both Jews and others hold in this country. Clearly, the election, as well as the pandemic, has created a kind of concern about the street and the behavior of civil unrest, of anti-Semitism, of anti-immigrant bashing, and of hate against other minorities has been particularly concerning. 64% of American Jews blame the problems on the alt-right and right-of-center political anti-Semitism. 16% label this of the political left. The Supreme Court is an item of major concern to certainly Jewish voters and remains so. And we will come back to that in a few moments. We are also looking at the rebuilding of the American economy following this pandemic. And I think in many ways, technology and the health system are going to be central pieces to the discussion about the future of our country and its directions. And as we have noted before, the public square is an important issue of making it safe from hate and dealing with the diversities and distress that seems to be very much part of the public sphere. And moving beyond the pandemic is certainly an issue that arises as we figure how we will rebuild our economy, manage health systems, and deal with the political divisions in our society. American Jews have talked to various pollsters about what troubles them and what issues define their voting. You see the high profile given to healthcare, to Social Security and Medicare. And I point those out together because of the age factor of American Jews. Being older voters, they are more likely to raise these considerations first and of greater priority. Gun violence and gun security is an issue that is also very dominant among Jewish voters, as we have seen. And certainly issues such as the environment, the economy, and immigration all represent additional considerations. And if this poll were to be taken in more recent days, it might well reflect a very high focus on the Supreme Court. But note the low level of commitment with regard to where Israel sits on the spectrum. Now, this should not be misread that American Jews don't care about Israel. But in the 2020 election, of all the competing issues, American Jews are basically saying, Israel is secure at this point. It is not in tension with Washington, and there are no immediate threats to Israel's viability and presence in the Middle East. So the argument here is that Israel is at a lower standard of importance at this point, but it should never be misunderstood that it is a very high profile issue for more than 80% of American Jews who will tell you that there is a special and unique relationship of their Jewishness to Israel and of the importance of the U.S.-Israel relationship. As a voting factor, however, it is significantly marginalized. The point that I would leave you with is that as America changes and as our Jewish community will be changing, how and what kind of political role American Jews will play in the future will be in play as we move forward. The second element that we need to think about is that the anti-Semitism that I describe, both right and left, is all about the question of Jewish whiteness. Are we too white in the eyes of some, or are we pretenders in the eyes of others? The question of our status and the battle against anti-Semitism is the second major concern. The third is the consideration that Jews care deeply about the American story, and they want others to care as well, because the more people that are engaged, the stronger the democracy and its viability and its civic connectiveness. So I would argue that these three issues of American Jewish political future is defined around fighting anti-Semitism, managing the changing American demographics, and creating a new thrust on civic engagement. I'm now open to taking your questions.
You spoke a lot about the Great Jewish Divide and spent time talking about different philosophies. And I was wondering two things. If you see that Jews also, that they're also in bubbles, that within the Jewish community, they bubble up as well. And if you've seen any examples, you showed how it can be damaging, but if you've seen any examples within the Jewish community of bridging that divide.
Yes, I mean, I think we are seeing some efforts to create conversations across tables, across this divide. And to the credit of a number of communities who have created these conversation possibilities, where Republicans and Democrats are able to find common ground, and where people with different views on Israel have been able to share discussions. That has been a unique breakthrough. The difficulty has been that these are sort of experiments in a conversation that needs to go deeper and needs to involve many more people and needs to diffuse the language that sometimes exists both in the press and between individuals as they hold these conversations. So we're in an early point in a kind of listening stage of where we need to hear each other and rebuild some of those difficult relationships.
Thanks. We have a question from Ron Feldman. He says, can you speak to the potentially dangerous connection between the relatively high percentage of Jewish money in elections and the rise of anti-Semitism on both sides?
Yes, Ron, that's an important question. And some of us are deeply concerned about how the reality of Jewish money being so prominent and so significant is playing out and may play out in terms of pushback from anti-Semites and others. This is a matter that a number of folks have been concerned about because of the whole historic issue of money lending and Jews with imagery of banking and economic power. And certainly those who are committed to hate will use this thematic principle in much of their work and thinking. So this has been an issue that both the ADL, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, and other groups have actually been debating in terms of how best to interpret and market the reality that Jews are active and proud and patriotic Americans. And part of that patriotism is expressed through voting, but it's also expressed through support of candidates and causes. But this is a difficult agenda, and we have seen a number of conspiratorial theorists play this out, mostly identifying particular individuals who are high profile in the Jewish community as sort of the villains, as ways by which they target Jews. Thank you for that question. So what I can do as you await for additional questions, I point to some very interesting players in the 2020 campaign. Many of you are aware that there are a number of candidates running for Senate, and we're watching three interesting races. Al Gross, who is running in Alaska, and is doing actually quite well. He's running against a Republican incumbent. And Dr. Gross is not a Democrat. He's running as an independent who will, quote, vote with the Democrats. He is one of several Jewish candidates running. The Democratic candidate in Wyoming is an Israeli-American Jewish academic. We have in Georgia, a Jewish candidate running against an incumbent. And we have on the House side a number of very interesting races involving young Republican women, Jewish women, running both in Florida, in Pennsylvania, and probably also in New York. Those races we're watching with great interest. We are seeing sort of the rise of a new generation of younger, both Republican and Democratic Jewish candidates, and especially women. And we saw a huge number of new women come into public office in 2018 in particular.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today we feature a special program on the 2020 elections and the Jewish vote, featuring political scientist and author Dr. Stephen Windmiller. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Also, to share with you just a few other interesting outcomes from 2020. We are looking at some interesting data on the fact that younger Jews who may not have voted in 2016 have become particularly energized and active, whether it's through Black Lives Matter or through other initiatives that have drawn their attention and their interest. And in a study that some of us have been involved with here in Southern California, looking at some of their political leanings, their priorities, and their voting behavior as we go forward. Because we think that with 26 million Americans taking to the street this summer, on behalf of various aspects of the Black Lives Matter case or agenda, we saw a significant number of younger Jewish activists. And studying them is a particular interest that some of us are exploring.
Okay, Ron again. Historically, I've always thought that the shift of Jews to the Democrats was really in support of FDR during the Nazi era. Can you talk about the history timeline?
Thank you again, Ron. Let's step back before we come to Franklin Roosevelt and take a look at 1864. Any of you around in 1864, mazel tov on how well you're doing. Lincoln runs for the second term and he wins the Jewish vote. He did not win the Jewish vote in 1860, but his performance, and this is a whole separate lecture about Lincoln and the Jews, which we could do another time. But Lincoln is a profoundly important figure. He dies on Passover, 1865. Mm-hmm. And the sermons delivered in the few number of congregations that existed in the country at the time is really phenomenal. He's seen as a kind of Moses figure. He's seen as saving the nation. And his legacy becomes a kind of Republican Jewish alignment of the Jewish vote, extensively supporting future Republican candidates, including Ulysses S. Grant, who many viewed as potentially anti-Semitic because of his actions in 1862 during the Civil War in terms of removal of Jewish peddlers from the Tennessee River Valley, the famous Order Number 11. But regardless, the Jewish requests to the Republican administrations included fighting against Tsarist Russian anti-Semitism, against the Swiss government and some of its rulings restricting Jewish travel, immigration, and trade, against Romania, against Hungary. And what we see is a very staunch and strong Republicanism from German Jews, who were the bedrock of the Jewish community of the period post-Civil War. With the arrival of the East European Jews, they come with socialist ideas, with communist ideas, with anarchistic notions, and they actually do not become Democrats immediately. Their role in the period 1880 to 1925 or thereabouts is to raise the progressive, radical, socialist perspectives as third-party candidates, as fringe-tied groups to the Democrats, and to influence politics, especially in the New York metropolitan area, where so many of these folks were living. While it is true that Roosevelt is the convener, in a sense, of the building of a coalition of farmers and Jews and others, blue-collar workers, into the Democratic Party under Roosevelt, this emerges actually over a period of 20 years, that Woodrow Wilson is profoundly important to Jewish voters in the period of 1916 and even earlier. And so I think we need to sort of see that this is a building of a phenomenon, of a base of Democratic Jewish support that follows Roosevelt and had continued well beyond Roosevelt. Now, if you go back to some of my writings, I write in around 2002, I make a proposition statement that Jews are becoming Republican. And what that is taken from was what we began to see with Ronald Reagan and with President Bush, both first and second, a growing commitment to conservative thought, to a pro-Israel agenda that found comfort and support with the Republican candidates and with Jewish voters finding a base there. But that did not sustain itself. And so my conversation to myself in 2002 was put on hold, basically, because we have sort of seen the restabilization of the Democratic majority. And what we are likely to see in 2020 may continue that pattern. But again, it's a bit early to predict outcomes of how Jews will vote in this election.
So thank you again, Dr. Windmuller, for educating us all. It's been really, truly wonderful to learn from you. So everybody, to find more resources and events in the Power Through Voting series, please visit jcceastbay.org/civic engagement. There you'll find a reading list on Jewish involvement in voting movements, printable signs that you're welcome to hang in the windows of your home to remind people passing by to register to vote, an event with author Ruby Shamir on how to talk to kids about politics, and information on an upcoming text bank party exclusively for young professionals that will address voter suppression in collaboration with the organization Reclaim Our Vote. Thank you again to all of you for joining us tonight, to Dr. Windmuller for sharing his election analysis with us, to Kimberly from the PJCC for leading the Q&A session, and to all of the JCCs of the Bay Area for creating the Power Through Voting series. Please do stay in touch and have a wonderful evening.
You've been listening to a special program on the 2020 elections and the Jewish vote, featuring political scientist and author Dr. Stephen Windmuller. We finish this hour with poet Juan Felipe Herrera, who was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017, and the first Hispanic poet to serve in the position. His new collection of poetry, Every Day We Get More Illegal, was released in September. Here is a highlight from Herrera's appearance at the JCCSF in 2015.
I want to thank the Jewish Cultural Center for inviting me. It's a great privilege to be here. It's a great honor to be here. My teachers, many of my teachers were Jewish, and they were the ones who encouraged me mostly and gave me so many key words and key books and told me many things and asked me many things that kind of shattered me on the spot. And I had to deal with those questions and deal with those phrases. Mr. Schuster in seventh grade, my music teacher, said, "What are you?" And I had to deal with that. I had come from San Francisco and gone back to San Diego. And I said, I'm Hawaiian. I'm Hawaiian. I had a hard time saying Mexican. I had a lot of Filipino friends in the Mission District. And I guess I wanted to be Hawaiian, but I really wasn't able to say Mexican. So because of Mr. Schuster's question, who was a great music teacher and wanted me to be in band, which I wanted to be in, I said, "No, Mr. Schuster, I'm not going to be in band. I have to work on something. I have to work on telling the truth, and I have to work on standing up, and I have to work on speaking out, and I have to work on getting my real voice out there. So I'm going to go into the class I do not want to go into. I wanted to be here. This was my dream, to play that saxophone. But I'm going to give it up because I want to say who I am. And I'm going to be in choir. Because, you know, in choir, you know, you get called on. Juan? Dr. Rossi? Can you please step up? But I'm okay, Dr. Rossi. No, please step up. But Dr. Rossi, I can, please step up, and that you have to sing by yourself to the piano after you hear the piano, without the piano. And that's what you have to do every day for years. And okay, Juan, go ahead. Can you play that again, Mark? Da 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 da. Ring. Da 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 da. Was that good enough, Dr. Rossi? Da 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 da. So the time came in the late 60s and early 70s when we were all involved in that beautiful thunderstorm of inspiration and reclamation of who we were. It wasn't just me, it was all of us. And right there in front of the fire, in front of the various forces that we had to deal with when we wanted to speak up as a whole, as a group, as various groups and social movements in the universities here in the Bay Area and throughout California, throughout the nation, and throughout the world. And the thing, I guess, was to grasp our stories and to bring out our stories in the present, to the public, for the public, and to listen to the people's stories, and to write them down. Let us gather in a flourishing way, with sun loose grains abriendo los cantos, opening the songs que cargamos cada día, that we carry every day, en el young pasto nuestro cuerpo para regalar on those green grasses our body to give. Feliz perlas, pearls, happiness, of corn flowing, árboles de vida, those trees of life, en las cuatro esquinas, on the four corners. Let us gather in a flourishing way, contentos, llenos de fuerza, filled with happiness, of strength, to vida, giving nacimientos and births and rebirths and renaissances, to fragrant ríos, dulces, frescos, verdes, turquoise, green and sweet, and fresh and strong, carne de nuestros hijos, carne de nuestras hijas, flesh of our bodies, of our sisters and brothers and daughters and sons, rainbows let us gather in a flourishing way, en la luz, en the light, en la carne, in the flesh of our heart to toil tranquilos, in serenity, in peace, in fields of blossoms, juntos to stretch los brazos together. May our arms come together, tranquilos in peace with the rain, en la mañana, in the morning, temprana estrella on our forehead, that morning star, cielo de calor and wisdom to meet us, that heaven, that firmament of heat and light where we toil forever, siempre. In the garden of our struggle and joy, let us offer our hearts a saludar to greet our águila rising, freedom, our eagle freedom, our rising eagle freedom, to celebrate woven brazos, branches, ramas and branches, and ramas and piedras and stones and nopales and cacti and plumas and feathers and piercing and bursting and figs, aguacates and ripe mariposa butterfly fields, and mares claros and clear seas and oceans, of our face to breathe, todos, all of us, on el, en el camino, on this road, on this path, blessing, seeds to give, to grow. Maíz land, that land of sacred corn, en las manos, in the hands of our nuestro amor. Thank you so much. So that's how I started, you know. That's where we started with those harmonics, those harmonics of our lives, those languages, those frontiers, those woven wounds and frontiers and borders and languages and both languages and three languages, Spanish and English and something that we created, right? And it was just the way we said it. It was just the way we said it. So time passed, and I was here in the Mission District in the Bay Area. I had been here in the 50s. My mother was, she called herself a salad girl. Era una salad girl, Juanito. Yo era una salad girl. And at St. Francis. So she used to work in the St. Francis as a salad girl in the 40s. And I always thought about that, a salad girl in the 40s at the St. Francis. And she told me about the movies that were playing in those days and the silent movies she loved to see, and Fatty Arbuckle and Gloria Swanson and Charlie Chaplin and just her life, you know, in San Francisco. So we came back in the 50s and then back to the fields. My parents were farm workers, and there was a time when my mother was here in the Bay Area before she got on the farm working road, and after she had been a washerwoman, to use that odd word, in El Paso and throughout California. So then the question became a question of, am I an immigrant? Are we immigrants? Are we migrants? Are we what? I think we are immigrants, but how could that be, since this land was our land? But so maybe we're just migrants, migrating like we have always migrated, from family to family, from trail to trail, to find that shrine where former families lived and to find an abode there. So maybe we're immigrants and migrants. But then again, there are laws that prohibit that and prohibit speaking in Spanish in the schools and in other places. So I guess we're none of those. So I guess we're something like exiles. But exiles of what? From where? So I wanted to look into those questions.
That was poet Juan Felipe Herrera from his appearance at the JCCSF in 2015. Herrera was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 2015 to 2017, and the first Hispanic poet to serve in the position. His new collection of poetry, Every Day We Get More Illegal, was released in September. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's Bina was a special program on the 2020 elections and the Jewish vote, featuring political scientist and author Dr. Stephen Windmiller. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.